ॐ सहनौ भवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्युषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः Good morning to everyone. So the topic for discussion is cultivating contentment. It's a very relevant and very important topic for our times. We will have a talk from 10 to 11:30. Then we will have interaction from 11 to, sorry, lecture from 10 to 11 and interaction, question answer session from 11 to 11:30. So if any of you finds it difficult to fully understand or follow what we are discussing here, you are most welcome to raise your questions and we'll have an active discussion after the lecture. So when we discuss this topic of contentment, we find normally there are three approaches to contentment. One approach is we try to experience contentment or satisfaction with whatever we have, without bothering or thinking much about it. The other one is a state of perpetual discontentment, where we never get complete satisfaction with whatever we are doing, and we constantly strive to improve and change, and we keep looking for something different that may give us contentment. The third approach is the spiritual approach, where you do not really look for contentment. And as a result, you're always in a state of perpetual contentment. If you do not look for happiness all the time, then we will never be unhappy. So there is an old Sanskrit dictum which I shall translate. So, asha hi paramam dukkham, nirasha paramam sukham. This is the meaning. Now, asha means expectation, desire, a state of perpetual dissatisfaction. In the Bible it is said, one method of torture in hell is to keep you perpetually dissatisfied. In fact, dissatisfaction or discontentment is the worst form of suffering. So, of course, this doesn't mean that we should not strive for something better. It doesn't mean that we should not try to improve our destiny. Even while working hard to improve our lot, even while striving for contentment, if you can remain perfectly happy, if you do not get everything going according to your way, then we will never be dissatisfied. We can constantly keep striving, trying, and do our best. That approach is called the approach of a yogi in Vedantic tradition. Now, what's the difference between a yogi and those who do not practice yoga? Yoga, please remember, yoga doesn't mean the physical exercise part of yoga. Yoga here means a very complete and integral approach to spiritual life. Life as a whole, in which the line of demarcation between the spiritual and the secular disappears, where every act, so-called secular activities, also get a spiritual orientation. In fact, that is the real meaning of yoga according to Patanjali. Patanjali devotes only one sutra. In 195 sutras, he devotes only one sutra to the physical part of yoga. Sthiram Sukhamasanam, that's all. The 194 sutras are devoted to building a healthy philosophy of life. So now, if you have this yogic approach in life, you can keep striving your best, working hard with a definite goal in mind. At the same time, if you do not fully succeed in achieving your goal, you will not become discontented. Still, you will strive. So there your mind reaches a state of equanimity where you are able to look beyond success and failure, and as a result, you experience a kind of inner contentment and joy. This is the highest approach towards the problem of discontentment. Means you do not look for contentment in the ordinary sense of the term. The best way to avoid unhappiness is to stop always looking for happiness. Now, this is the approach in Vedanta. Now, how do we achieve this? I shall give in a nutshell what we are going to discuss today. How do we reach this level of mental equanimity? So remember, mental equanimity is another name for contentment. When we are fully content, fully satisfied, then we reach a stage where we feel that there is no need to look for something beyond. It doesn't mean total inactivity or inaction, not at all. That's a very important point to remember. Not inactivity or inaction. I shall try to substantiate this point with the help of a great Sanskrit verse. Now, there is a reason why I'm quoting the Sanskrit verse. There is a great psychological explanation for this. This ancient wisdom of spiritual contentment was a theme of great teachers in ancient times. So all the great mystics and philosophers and spiritual personalities could work so much for the good of humanity because they had within their mind this spiritual contentment. So when we quote an ancient verse, we are in distinguished company. We feel we are part of an ancient tradition, a succession. So we are in the company of Jesus, Buddha, Shankaracharya, Ramakrishna, Paramahamsa, St. Francis of Assisi and others. We are not alone. In fact, loneliness is one serious cause for discontentment. So that's why I'm quoting this verse. We are in distinguished company, part of an ancient tradition. Now, the verse is this. Saktaha karmani avidvamso yatha kurvanti bharata kuryan vidvan tatha asaktaha chigishu loka sangraham. This is a very interesting verse. Now, it compares the attitudes of two types of people. Those who are wise, spiritually wise, those who are experiencing inner contentment, serenity and peace, but always active, not inactive. The so-called inaction, inactivity cannot give you contentment. So, there are those wise people who are experiencing this inner contentment. They're called yogis. Again, yoga doesn't mean here physical exercise. Yoga here means a spiritual approach to life as a whole. Spiritualizing our every act, every thought. Sublimating our life to a higher spiritual dimension, transcendental dimension, where we look for something higher than success and failure in the empirical sense. That's the meaning of yoga here. Now, they are always active, but they are not obsessed, they are not enslaved by their attachment to success all the time. That means they work hard, and if they work hard without any such entanglement, they can put more energy and more effort, more concentration into the work they are doing. So they are called the spiritually enlightened persons. They are always active. Then there is the other side. They don't bother much about yoga or spirituality. Work hard 13 hours, 14, 15 hours a day. Workaholics. A very high level of professionalism, efficiency, zeal and enthusiasm. And they succeed. In many ways they succeed. But at the end of the day, they had to take pills for getting 3-4 hours sleep every day. Because at the end of the day, they do not have the mental health to enjoy the money they have accumulated. So these are called problems of success. Success also has its own problems. That's why Gita gives one link into Vedantic tradition in general, one clue to achieving this level of spiritual equanimity. Being always active, do your duty, still remaining in a state of perfect contentment and serenity and peace. We have to link ourselves to a higher spiritual goal. That's one clue that Vedantic tradition in general gives. Right now, we are linked to work and its consequences. We work, and when we do work, we always link that work to its immediate result. So people are not really worried about work. They are worried only about the results of their work. The so-called anxiety and worry are not problems of work. They're problems of thinking too much about the results, worrying about the results of the work. Now, Vedanta tells you that you break this link. Do your best, because action is unavoidable. Even the highest spiritual seeker cannot really remain inactive, both physically and mentally. Meditation also is an action. Scriptural reading is an action, not physical action. So physical and mental inactivity together is impossible. But then if actions are always linked to the immediate results of actions, then there is no end to worry and anxiety. So this link that connects our work and its result should be broken mentally. So what we must do, we must link ourselves to a higher goal. Not to the results of what we are doing, but a higher spiritual goal. And once we are linked to that, is a transcendental spiritual ideal. And when we are linked to that, then we can be free from discontentment and anxiety and other problems. This is how it works. Now, coming to the practical life, to understand this, we must think of how our mind works. You know, one of the most exhaustive theses on human psychology, maybe the most ancient human effort to analyze the workings of human mind, is the Patanjali's yoga system. Patanjali is a great psychologist, sage, who lived maybe around 2,500 years before, BC before Jesus Christ. Now he wrote this famous book, which I'm not going to deal with right now. He analyzes the mental world in a very scientific, rational way. He says, our whole mental activities can be analyzed and studied from three angles. One, our experiences. Experiences not only coming from external objects, but also internal feelings and emotions. happiness, unhappiness, and also external experiences that we encounter from other people, different situations in life. So experience is the first, it's called bhoga in the Patanjali system. And the other side is our reaction, our psychological, emotional, volitional reactions to this experience. These reactions are divided into three categories by Patanjali. When we read this, we understand we all practically go through these experiences. One is raga, which means we like certain things. It may not be good for us, but still we get obsessed with certain things. There's always, you can find a problem of the conflict between mind and intellect. You can find in our own life. We want to do certain things. We sincerely have a desire to do certain things. At the intellectual level, we are convinced we should do that. But when we try to do that, we are not able to do that. Our body we can control, a machine we can control, but we can never predict what thoughts are going to emerge in our mind next second. If you prepare a list of words that you are going to speak during the next 10 minutes, you can never really do that. What thought is going to emerge in our mind in next 5 minutes, we have no control. So, there are certain things that we want to do but we cannot do. So there is a wide gap between mind and intellect, between what we would like to do and what we are able to do. So it is because, of course, according to Yoga Vedanta system, it's because of the accumulated tendencies and impressions that we have gathered in our mental system, not in this life, but in previous life. Now, coming to that, we'll come to that later. So, the first part is experience or bhoga. Then, our reactions to these experiences, which are divided into three categories. One is in the form of extreme obsession towards certain experiences that we like, even if we do not really want them, but we cannot, we are helpless, we cannot avoid them. It is called raga. The second one is dvesha. We hate certain things. We have a strong dislike. A psychologist or hypnotist may try to hypnotize you and try to analyze, try to find out the cause of phobias and conflicts based on the experiences of your this life. But there are many problems which cannot be fully explained in the light of your experiences in this life. So Vedanta and yoga philosophical systems take you beyond your present life. Because one important aspect of yoga is you don't have just one life. Life is not an experience that begins in the cradle and comes to an end with a piece of stone in the cemetery. Life continues. That is the journey of the body, which even if you do your best, cannot be immortal. So there is something which beyond this body which continues to live. So our mental system accumulates impressions, tendencies, vasanas and samskaras for ages, for lives, and they remain accumulated in the mental system, and they control, they influence our reactions to various experiences. Now, so these reactions can be in the form of extreme obsessive attachment or liking for certain things, or hatred, aversion, is called dvesha. The third reaction of the mind towards experiences is bhaya, it means fear, moving away from certain things. Now, all these three reactions are reactions to experiences, inner experiences, also external experiences. That's why in one of the very important verses in the sixth chapter of Gita, there's a very interesting analysis of human life. It is related to the doctrines of law of karma and rebirth, how we accumulate different emotions and impressions in our mind. So when we go to a doctor asking for an explanation why we are facing this problem, this anxiety, which we cannot really explain, he may give us a medicine, but that will work only for a short time. It is only postponement of problems, postponing the problem for another day, that's all. But if you understand the inner workings of the human mind in the light of yoga and Vedanta, we may find some of our own explanations and we'll be able to come out of it. Oh, Edgar Cayce overdid it. So often people lost faith in his theories, that's what, in early days. But the law of karma and rebirth are very scientific. Okay, I'm coming to this episode in the Gita. In the sixth chapter, Arjuna, like many of us, may ask questions. Like that, he's asking a question to his teacher. He's putting a question to his teacher, Lord Krishna. The question is very simple. The teacher, Lord Krishna, had already taught him how to meditate, how to do our duty as an offering to God, different aspects of devotion, different spiritual metaphysical systems. All these ideas were briefly taught. But Arjuna still had one very nagging doubt. He said, well, suppose a person tries his best to meditate, to read scriptures, to regulate his or her life. I mean, to practice restraint and control, self-control in his habits, activities, words, and trying his best to, or his, her best to achieve inner contentment and serenity. And if he doesn't succeed, suppose he has a deviation, it happens sometimes. That's one major problem. People feel, well, I couldn't succeed. I am not able to succeed. I am not able to meditate. It's a big problem. It's really not a big problem in Vedanta. If you don't succeed in your first effort, it is not a problem in Vedanta. That's the great promise which Lord Krishna is giving in this chapter. So there is a verse in the sixth chapter. Ayadi Sriddhayo Pedu Yoga Chalida Manasaha Aprapi Yoga Samsiddhim Kam Gatim Krishna Gichidi. This is the verse. He's asking this question. A spiritual seeker who is trying to meditate, to pray, to do japa, but still is not able to succeed. Sometimes he may have a deviation, a distraction, he may have a fall, or he may die before he reaches his supreme spiritual goal. Does it mean that all the efforts are gone, waste, because only one life? Your body is over, so your life is also over. Then what's the use of it? You see, if you are practicing for Olympics, and if the courts tell you you had to reach the highest point at the first try, then nobody will go for it. So you can continue trying for it. So, is it that if you do not succeed in this life, everything is lost? Or is there any hope for people who do not fully succeed? This is the question that Arjuna puts to Krishna. It's a very universal question, which is asked in all spiritual traditions, all religious traditions, and all psychiatric clinics also, in different languages, of course. Now, the answer given is this. Look here. Even if you try to practice, even if you do not practice, but if we make a sincere effort to practice once, to pray, to meditate. Or there is another kind of practice. You try to help somebody. If somebody is trying to walk the street, cross the street, you help him, the blind man. Or you pay a small donation to philanthropical organizations, Ebola or AIDS, all these big philanthropical organizations. The slightest bit of good action, good thought, or even effort, an effort, which may not be successful effort, still an attempt to do something, it will have its positive effect in our human mental system. And that's why we should always strive to keep our keep feeding our mind with good thoughts, good ideas. So, even the slightest bit of effort to do good, to pray, to meditate, will be like a capital, a huge amount that you are investing in the bank, a spiritual bank. Then the next Krishna says, when the verse is the tatratam buddhisam yogam labhade paurodekhikam yatadecha tato bhuya samsiddho kurunantana. It's a very famous verse. What happens, you know? Suppose you walk in San Francisco streets. You see many places. There are meditation centers. There are wonderful places which will help you to continue your spiritual life, to enrich your life. And there are also places somewhat different from this, which I need not mention. Now, when you see the billboard, when you see an advertisement in newspapers, sometimes we feel drawn towards certain higher ideas, higher places. Why? We have done it in the past. If not in this life, in previous life. So, this tendency, this impression, that is created when you did something noble sometime in one of your past lives, will come to your rescue and will help you to continue your spiritual life from today. So, even if we make the slightest effort to practice spiritual, to do spiritual practice, it creates an impression in the mind. Because whatever we do, according to yoga, it becomes a vritti. Vritti means a tendency or a modification in the mind. So there's a cycle which continues moving, you know. Whatever we do, it creates a residual effort in our mind. If you do something noble, any of us can try. Even if we make a small donation to some earthquakes victims or natural calamity victims, they send a check, that day you'll find, oh, I've done something wonderful. It may not last for long, but then it will have a soothing effect. The slightest good action in love, compassion, broad-mindedness, charitable feeling, or anything, it will have an ennobling, elevating effect on our mental system. Why? Because it suddenly creates a new spiritual deposit, a spiritual vibration. And it works as a soothing, as a spiritualizing, harmonizing factor. It becomes a soothing experience within when we do something noble. It may not be an action, even a noble thought. So this is called vritti. Vritti becomes a vasana. Vasana is a strong tendency which may prompt you to further action. Suppose you have done something noble, it will create you a good feeling within. And then what happens? Then you have a tendency to continue the same action. And vasana becomes a samskara. So samskaras and vasanas go together. And then sankalpa, it is called. You may take a decision to continue to do the same thing again. And that will result in your repetition of the same noble act. It may be a noble deed, a noble thought, or our own spiritual practice. So what Lord Krishna says is, all these samskaras which elevate our mind, which enrich our personality, remain accumulated in the mental system. So that perhaps that is our life has come to an end. But next life, what happens when we find ourselves in an identical situation, condition, these samskaras will again awaken in the mind and will prompt us to continue the same noble deed again and again. So that's why it is said that we must always continue feeding the mind with good thoughts, good ideas, good samskaras and good modifications. And when these good samskaras increase in number, what happens? Then it takes the form of contentment. It is totally different from the satisfaction that we get when you get a new car, when you get a good job. No. Because the satisfaction that comes when you get a good job disappears when you are fired from that job, maybe after some years, or even before that. The satisfaction that money brings is lost when money is lost. But this contentment, which is spiritual contentment, which functions like a soothing, enriching, elevating mental experience, it is permanent. So, now the question arises, frequently, you know, when we talk about contentment, when you talk about happiness, one major problem that we may experience is, what about the daily problems and worries? This is a high ideal, we may think. What about the daily problems and worries? So, in fact, Patanjali's yoga system gives a very interesting suggestion. You sublimate your worries. You try to learn to worry about great things. That's something. When we worry about great things, it is not really worry. Worry becomes a big strain, a painful experience, only when we worry about our own things. When we worry about small things, it is hurting, it's painful. When we worry about higher things, it is no more a painful experience. So you can remember Buddha's, you know. Buddha is a classic example who worried about big problems of the world. Buddha really had no problem in a purely empirical sense. He was born as a prince in a palace. He lived. He had all luxuries. Till his 28th year, he had no problem. Then one day when he was walking, when he was going around the city, he happened to see the face of a sick man. He happened to see the dead body, a procession, funeral procession. And he happened to see the face of a sick person. And then he saw a person who was free from all problems, a saint. So he thought, well, I have all good things of life for me in my palace. But still, that's not enough. I may also become old and sick and may die like this old man who has passed away, the funeral procession. That means life is not complete. Now remember, that problem is different from the problem that many people face. That problem may not have taken the form of a painful experience. In fact, it is the opening of a spiritual illumination for him. So if you can worry about higher things, bigger things, then worry itself gets sublimated. So that is an interesting lesson we have to learn from Buddha's life. You find many of the great men of the world and men and women became great because they worried about higher problems. They sublimated their worries and problems. That's why it is, we should not always expect happiness in life. Once we do not always expect happiness, then we have no problem of unhappiness. If you look, if you open the eyes and look around, we find everything in this empirical world is subject to change. And anything that is subject to change is transitory. It is not, it's not immortal. It's not eternal. It remains for some time, then it vanishes. So why should we expect these empirical things which are non-eternal, which are subject to changes, to give us eternal contentment? So one problem is that we expect contentment and happiness everywhere, and this expectation lands us in trouble, so we face discontentment and unhappiness. So one solution is to worry about higher things, bigger things. So, and that again takes us to the problem of everyday life and action. As I said earlier, we cannot remain inactive even for one split second, mentally and physically. And action is always accompanied by worry about its results. And this worry creates problems and discontentment. So how, at the same time, action is unavoidable. So how to remain active and at the same time be free from the problems of action? So one solution is given in the form of yoga, and this yoga is divided into three approaches. The way to perpetual permanent contentment. It is Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. In the Karma Yoga, you find a very wonderful, very relevant method for attaining contentment in modern times. As I said, we cannot remain inactive. And actions always produce some problems. Even successful actions create problems. As I said, problems of success, problems of abundance. You find some of the countries with the highest per capita income, the highest level of scientific technological development, have got the highest level of depression, anxiety, and suicide. So you can find this contrast, where everything is perfectly all right from an empirical point of view, as it was the case for Buddha. Insurance, social security, Medicare, education, everything is provided by the state in countries like Sweden, Holland, and in many advanced countries, countries like Japan, where everything is looked after. But still, a very high level of depression, anxiety, neurosis, and other problems. So we see a classic example of how success breeds greater problems. Now, how can we combine success and contentment? How can we succeed in material life and still avoid the problems of success? So Gita, as I said earlier, gives this solution, Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga is nothing but combining karma with yoga. Karma means action. All that we can consider as the integral elements of secular life, professionalism, punctuality, enthusiasm, efficiency, all these can be combined, can be categorized under karma. Yoga means, in spite of all this, you remain in a state of perfect equanimity and contentment through non-attachment. This is an interesting method which you find in the Gita. So, how to combine action and contemplation? Action alone cannot bring us happiness. Contemplation alone cannot give us happiness, because contemplation will not ensure prosperity and success in material life. So both action and contemplation are necessary. The idea of combining action and contemplation is called the principle of a Rajarshi. I have to use some of these terms because in Vedantic text, some of these ideas have been wonderfully explained. In the Gita, in the fourth chapter, Lord Krishna gives a very interesting exposition of this tradition of combining action and contemplation, efficiency and spiritual non-attachment, spiritual contentment. So he gives a list of the great kings of ancient times. Of course, we are not concerned with the mythological part of it, but we may just quote it just for academic interest. Imam vivasude yogam proktavanaham avyam vivasvan manave praha manu ikshagave bravit evam parampara praptam imam rajasyo viduhu sakalena ihamahada yogo nashta parandava. These are two verses which you need not worry about, but I shall give the relevant part and try to explain it. Fourth chapter, the first and second verses you can read later. The subject is this. Lord Krishna here gives a very wonderful exposition of integrated life, combining the spiritual and the secular. How to combine the spiritual and secular in such a way that the demarcation, line of demarcation between the two vanishes. So he uses one term, Rajarshi, which you'll find in Plato's Republic, the philosopher king. It is an ancient concept which you find in the Gita. Plato puts in different language in the Republic, the philosopher king. So you should be a king. Remember, not kings of our times, the British sovereign, because they have nothing to do, in fact, you know. Modern times. We are talking about kings and emperors who ruled the world in ancient times. So in ancient classical work, mind you. So they had to be very efficient, very active, very successful. They should be very competent. So the highest degree of activity, success, efficiency, workaholism, all these were necessary for kings in ancient times. But then he should also be a rishi. Rishi means a great philosopher, saint. Rishi means a person who can see far, who can see beyond today, beyond the present, who can look far beyond. Is one of the most wonderful concepts in Vedantic tradition. Now, the idea is this. Rajatvam means the condition of a king, which is related to prosperity, wealth, efficiency, workaholism, as in any modern business executive, company executive in modern times, has to be. You have to be active, you have to be competitive, you should be efficient, you should be professional, all that. But then you know that this active, efficient life may not give us contentment. That's why we are assembled here, in fact. You find some of the most successful executives, as good as the ancient kings, are not happy within. So there is something lacking. And what is that something? The ideal of a rishi. Rishi means a saint. The characteristic of a saint is this. He recognizes the need for prosperity. He recognizes the need for efficiency, action, professionalism. But he also recognizes the limitation of efficiency, the limitation of professionalism, and the limitation of prosperity that it brings. So the ability to combine the best of the secular and also the spiritual farsight to recognize its limitation, the limitation of material prosperity. That is the essence of a philosopher king in the Gita. That's what we need today. So if we can work hard for achieving the best of secular life and professional life, and still if we can have the spiritual insight to recognize the limitation of it, then we become real philosophers. That is the ideal of Gita. In fact, that's how we combine karma and yoga. Karma, action, makes us efficient and brings prosperity. It is related to the realities of everyday empirical life. But yoga enables you to have the insight. It gives you the insight to see the limitation of prosperity, because prosperity is necessary, money is necessary, action is necessary. But if you are obsessed with that, the problem is discontentment. So if you want contentment, you have to combine action with contemplation. And contemplation comes from yoga, where yoga links us to the infinite, the transcendental. That's the real meaning of yoga. So there are two definitions, you know. One is yoga, samadhi is one definition, yoga is samadhi. Another one is, you know, yoga means it links us to the infinite, the transcendental spiritual wisdom, which enables us to have the insight, the spiritual insight, to recognize the limitation of the empirical, the limitation of action, the limitation of prosperity and the secular achievements, so that we will be able to enjoy secular achievements. We will be able to enjoy the results of our actions only if you understand the limitations of the results. A person who thinks money is everything is not going to have any contentment in his life, in this life at least. A person who thinks success is the only way to achieve contentment, to achieve satisfaction, contentment, he is not going to have any contentment, because you can never have success all the time. Impossible. Success is just one side of the reality. The other side of the coin is failure. Pain and pleasure, you cannot have just a coin with only one side. A coin should have two sides. Pain on one side and pleasure on the other side. So anything that belongs to this world, the secular, will have two sides. Success and failure, pain and pleasure. So how to recognize this? You should go beyond both, beyond failure and success, beyond pain and pleasure. So yoga tells you this much. You have the best of this world, but remember, it is not going to stay forever. It's not going to be eternal. It's not going to be there after some time. It has come, it will vanish. Once you recognize this, this wisdom will enable us to have contentment, not only when everything is going fine, but also when something is going wrong, we will have contentment. So contentment linked to success and happiness all the time cannot be perpetual. It will only temporary. It cannot be permanent, because every experience of success will be continued, will be followed by some experience of failure. That's why one of the commentators, ancient commentators of Gita, says, Rishittvam tasyaka sukshmartha darsana kshamattvam. What is the characteristics of a saint, a philosopher king? That is the description. You know what he says? The ability to recognize the fact that the secular prosperity, though it is necessary for us, will not be permanent. Once we recognize this reality of its impermanence, then we have no problem for living this world. That's how we combine karma and yoga. Yoga gives the philosophical wisdom and the spiritual insight to recognize the reality of impermanence of all that we experience in our everyday life. And karma brings us, karma enables us to confront the realities of everyday life. Yoga gives us the wisdom to face the problems that we have to encounter. So now we will have interaction for more than 30 minutes. Perhaps that will be much more helpful, and then we'll continue the session next day. So those of you who would like to ask questions, you're most welcome.